Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling, and he is Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've got some news from grocery. Just a week after looking ahead to Southeastern Grocers, they make a big announcement that had a couple of impacts stemming from it. We'll also look about produce pandemic buying patterns. We've talked about frozen foods and meat and consumer staples. Haven't talked about produce in depth yet, but we get new numbers as far as Q1 produce sales in retail stores. And we'll also talk about Gap as they released earnings, and they're also a target of a lawsuit from Simon Property Group. A little bit later on, we'll be joined by Danny Cushion, the CMO at Cardlytics. Danny will be joining us to discuss the latest numbers surrounding Cardlytics. And what they're doing is they're kind of producing a bi-weekly state of the consumer report that is showing spending trends surrounding not only the pandemic, but where spending trends are going. It's hugely valuable information because they have the ability to look into one out of every two, so 50% credit card transactions in the U.S. That is a mind-blowing number. Danny's got a lot of great information to share surrounding that data. You can like us and rate us however you find us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Podcast Addict. Maybe it's Blueberry that you listen to. You can rate us on any of those platforms. Your ratings do help others to find our show. That is, if you like us, of course. And you can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. So we begin with Gap, as we mentioned. Kind of a two-pronged story here. Early in the week, they were a target of a lawsuit. Then they released earnings. Now, the lawsuit part of things, that's especially important for many retailers and landlords because we're in this brave new world. We don't know that there's any precedent into how missed rent payments from March through May may be treated. This may set a precedent, especially with the amount of exposure Simon has to Gap. But we want to start with earnings from the company that's seen massive amount of furloughs with their employees in the physical locations, most of their locations having been closed for some time, only now getting about half of their locations back up and running.
Now we'll dig into the numbers. This was for their quarter ending May 2nd. Their earnings release began the way we expected, with a 43% year-over-year sales decline. So again, 43% off in terms of year-over-year revenue. No surprise here. The decline was caused by widespread store closures experienced during the pandemic. Their stores largely closed in the United States on March 19th, just a few days after they announced a reduction in store hours. For what it's worth, their brick-and-mortar sales were down 61% year-over-year. They didn't provide comps. However, what was a massive surprise to us was the lack of e-commerce sales to help make up for the store closures. Indeed, their e-commerce sales, or online sales as they put it, were up only 13% year-over-year. This number is what we would have expected if there was no pandemic and is in line with what most apparel retailers have seen in normal conditions. So factor in normal here as sort of your baseline for the 13% jump year-over-year. People weren't in their stores, and that kind of proves out maybe that people weren't that excited about their selections online either. It was up 40% in April, suggesting that their e-commerce numbers were just awful in February and March. They did say that they saw a 100% year-over-year e-commerce sales increase in May alone. However, this only impacted 2 days of the first quarter and came too late for them on this call. In discussing the cadence of their sales, they noted that the quarter began with strength from brick-and-mortar sales perspective in February, but that quickly turned south under pandemic conditions. Indeed, around 90% of their store base was closed by March 20th, including U.S. locations. Despite only getting brick-and-mortar sales for around half of the quarter, brick-and-mortar sales still accounted for a whopping 75% of their net sales during the first quarter. To no one's surprise, they saw massive impairment charges in the quarter resulting from decreased sales. First, there was a non-cash impairment charge relating to store assets of $484 million. Second, there was a $235 million non-cash inventory impairment charge, When you look at their brands as a whole, Old Navy was by far and away the best performer in the quarter. Net sales were down 42% for Old Navy, outpacing their company average. And if you see, their e-commerce sales at Old Navy saw an increase of 20%, which is amazing when you compare them to maybe the e-commerce sales at Gap and Banana Republic. Gap was a train wreck as in-store sales were down around 64%, while online sales were down 5%. They were down 5% in a circumstance where customers can only buy online. The last 6 weeks of the quarter proved that customers didn't miss Gap in the slightest. The company did say that sales perked up towards the end of the quarter at Gap, but said they were done by inconsistent execution of product and marketing messages. We should keep in mind that the company came into the year with the intent of closing 170 stores that were Gap branded. If anything, this quarter suggests that the company had the right idea there, and we wonder how much longer the Gap brand can last. When compared to Gap, Banana Republic looked just okay, but still awful when compared to most retailers out there, most apparel retailers, that is. Their overall sales saw a decrease of 47%, 61% decrease in brick and mortar, and a 2% decrease, again, in e-commerce. The company blamed this on the shift to casual fashion during the stay-at-home requirements. Athleta, meanwhile, underscored that the company's plan to add stores under this banner is justified. Net sales were only down 8%, helped by a whopping increase in online sales of 49%. All of this led to, Trent, an operating loss of $1.2 billion in the quarter. Those impairment charges didn't help, and just not being open in any form and not having good online execution certainly played a part in that huge loss.
And I do want to underscore the fact that that loss, that $1.2 billion, that led a lot of headlines during the week. But we need to keep in mind that this is due in part to those non-cash impairments, Layton, that you mentioned. So it's not a situation where $1.2 billion in cash just left the company in the quarter, as most media outlets would have you believe. Still, the situation isn't a good one for Gap, considering furloughs, considering missed rent payments. They announced in April that they just weren't going to pay rent on their closed stores. The fact that they still lost this amount is not a positive sign, especially as they continue to maybe not pay rent for stores that are reopening. So, of course, Gap blamed the impairments and closed stores. One other thing they mentioned is inventory markdowns, and that caused a significant decrease in margin during the quarter. They actually gave away from the Banana Republic brand about $20 million in brand new merchandise to those in need. That's because they had that merchandise on hand. So you've got that merchandise on hand and you've got this big decision. You know, they chose to give $20 million of their inventory away. And actually, inventory, given the circumstance, was relatively flat for them overall. We didn't see a massive increase in inventory on hand, but as we'll talk about on this show next week with Nikki Baird of Aptos, there's a big decision here as far as what you do with the merchandise for an apparel retailer. Do you mark it down and maybe adjust consumer expectations to where when the markdowns stop, customers stop coming in? Do you mothball it until next year, considering that you never really rolled the merchandise out other than in e-commerce this year? Do you sell it to an off-price store? So you've got a lot of decisions that you have to make, and you have to make them relatively quickly. And the decisions for these apparel retailers could really set them up because they need that cash on hand for Q4 buying at this point, and in some cases Q3 buying if your quarters are slightly offset. So a big decision coming up. We saw from Gap, again, they decided to mark down a lot of their merchandise or in certain circumstances give it away rather than mothball it because, again, as we mentioned, inventory values relatively flat year over year. Now, new CEO Sonia Syngal said that customers' increased push to purchase goods through e-commerce channels or buy online pickup in store may leave the company well-positioned in the near future. Layton mentioned that May e-commerce sales were actually up about 100% year over year, so people are starting to look towards those e-commerce channels. They've focused also on reopening some of their stores with an eye towards omnichannel fulfillment. As of the earnings release, when you look at the stores they've reopened, about 55% of their North American store base was back open entirely, albeit with some reduced hours. But allowing people inside the store and so forth. However, 90% of their store base was in a position to fulfill e-commerce orders through buy online, pickup in store, meaning that they've got a chunk of their store base, about 35%, that isn't open. They're kind of those darker gray stores that we've been hearing about in the media, but that are available to fulfill e-commerce orders through buy online, pickup in store. And they also mentioned that they would once again look at their real estate portfolio to evaluate where things could be trimmed back. As Layton talked about, a number of closures were already planned for Gap. They were looking at closing about 170 stores during this calendar year, aiming to open stores from Old Navy and Athleta. They were looking at maybe 90 net store closures. But after this quarter, they noted the need to trim back Banana Republic stores as well. So we're likely looking at net store closures in the three figures. Probably not looking at as many openings for them either because the pandemic obviously shifting where they need to use their cash. Currently, just to put this in perspective, they have about 3,313 company-operated stores worldwide. That doesn't include the 600 or so licensed locations that they have out there. So when we're looking at these net closures, it is still a comparative drop in the bucket to the number of overall locations that they have, even if their closures reach into the three figures. Now, the good news, if there is any, is that the company's cash position is still decent. And I think this is something that a lot of people were glossing over. Now, we were very critical of their results in this quarter, especially given the tepid e-commerce sales. We've known for a while Old Navy is the brand that drives Gap. Gap and Banana Republic have been struggling for years. Those struggles certainly continued. Despite all of that, their cash position is still okay. They did lose about $600 million in cash and cash equivalents during the quarter. So not that $1.2 billion mark that we were talking about, but still a pretty hearty sum. But even after that, they still have $1.1 billion in cash and cash equivalents on hand, and they opened a new revolving credit facility to replace their earlier revolving credit facility. The new one totals nearly $1.9 billion, and they have yet to dip into it. So you're looking at about between the cash and cash equivalents and the revolving credit facility in the neighborhood of $3 billion with which they can work before getting into a really dire circumstance like what we've seen befall other retailers. So their cash position is still okay, given the fact that they have a couple of brands in their portfolio that have just been struggling. And Layton, they might need to use some of that cash after Simon filed a lawsuit in Delaware.
Yeah, that lawsuit also hit a lot of the major media outlets, and you saw a lot of negative headlines talking about the war between landlords and tenants. And I think this really speaks to how much this pandemic is affecting everybody. So pretty much every stakeholder within not only retail, but also commercial real estate. So you have a lot of issues right now going on. It's been widely discussed by us and others that many retailers haven't been paying rent during the pandemic, especially where they've been forced to close. So some states have introduced leniency provisions. Kansas, for example, passed a law for residents that also applied to commercial businesses. The lawsuit alleges that Gap has failed to pay $65.9 million in rent and other charges. In an article on The Real Deal, they quoted David Simon's discussion on Simon's recent earnings call regarding tenants who are behind on rent. Simon was quoted on the call as saying, "The bottom line is that we do have a contract and we do expect to get paid." He's got a point, and typically landlords haven't been super willing to just look the other way for tenants during stressful times. And while Gap might potentially have a case regarding not paying rent in March, their leverage of locations as buy online, pick up in store outlets as the pandemic went on leaves them with little negotiating leverage. The lawsuit, in fact, alleges that they haven't paid rent for April, May, or June of 2020. And by May, many locations were operational, at least in some way. Gap had said before that they would not be paying rent for stores that were closed. However, this lawsuit suggests that rent might not be getting paid for reopened locations, although the suit doesn't specify if rent might be getting paid at some of the locations and not others. Simon has pretty large exposure overall to Gap brands, over 400 locations in all. According to CNBC, Gap is Simon's largest tenant in terms of paid rents outside of the typical anchors. The reality is, the outcome here could determine a potential path forward for smaller landlords to whom Gap owes rent. Does Gap have a case if the mall itself is closed? How do government requirements to force closures also play in? Big question there. It will be interesting to see to what extent Simon stands their ground, knowing that it is important to set a strong precedent for not only this case, but for all of the other retailers affected in this scenario.
So that's our look into Gap as our lead story. Now, coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Danny Cushion, CMO at Cardlytics, who will talk over their recent data, some as recent as June, talking about the potential recovery in terms of consumer spending and how people are spending their money now that we're entering kind of this new normal. Retail Focus Podcast, pleased to be brought to you this week by Easy Texting. Founded in 2004, Easy Texting has served over 160,000 customers and is the number one SMS marketing software, having delivered over 5 billion messages for their customers. You know, Leighton, we've talked about it in previous episodes, but texting delivers way more engagement than email. You delete an email, that's easy enough to do, but you're going to look at a text. That's why it delivers 600% more engagement than email, and text messages are 134% more likely to be read than emails, and Easy Texting can help your business deliver the message.
That's right. For large and small businesses, you can do a number of things. You can facilitate scheduling. You can send your employees their schedule via text. You can expand your workforce by messaging a list of previous applicants. For retailers, you can let your most loyal shoppers know about changes to the store hours, which is really relevant right now during this time, new curbside pickup policies, when certain items restock, or when new merchandise arrives, and of course, many, many more things there. Provide also an excellent customer experience overall. Let's say your customer buys a piece of furniture. They can be texted assembly instructions that maybe were left out. You can ask them how they liked a particular product or service. The list goes on and on.
There's a reason 89% of customers prefer messaging to communicate with businesses. Easy Texting is offering a free trial to listeners of the Retail Focus podcast. You can text RETAIL to 858585 to opt into this free trial. Now, message and data rates may apply for this recurring message program. But again, text RETAIL to 858585. If you're driving in your car, if you can't write that down, we're going to put it in the show notes. Once again, Easy Texting's free trial to listeners of the Retail Focus podcast, available by texting RETAIL to 858585. Well, as we've discussed on recent shows, we're trying to change our focus a little bit and not looking so much back as far as the data coming out of COVID-19, but we're looking forward as far as spending trends are concerned. And who better to talk with about those spending trends than someone from Cardlytics, most notably Danny Cushion, the CMO of Cardlytics. We've had her on the show several times now, but again, Cardlytics has just a massive data set to work with. They also just recently released their state of spend for May 2020. Danny, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be back on.
So as we often do, for those that maybe haven't heard you or heard about Cardlytics yet, what is the data set that you're working with and where does this data come from?
Yep, it's a great question. And I'll explain a little bit who we are because that puts it into context. So Cardlytics is a company that runs cashback rewards programs and advertising for some of the biggest banks in the U.S. So that includes folks like Bank of America and Chase, and recently just finished rolling out with Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo consumers now see our cashback offers. So as a result of that, we're actually one of the country's biggest digital ad platforms. A lot of people just don't know our name because it's the banks that are the names that matter to be out there, not ours so much. But what we do is, since we are actually able to help marketers reach bank customers, and we reach about 140 million of them in the U.S., we help them reach bank customers with targeted ads that give them a chance to earn money back on the stuff that they are buying already, or that they, you know, might have some kind of intent to buy. And so through the partnerships with the banks love this program because it helps, you know, drive digital engagement, and it gives their consumers cash back on their purchases. But as a result of our relationship, we use the purchase data from the banks, and all aggregated and anonymized. But we use that to help our marketing clients solve some pretty interesting problems. And so the data that we're looking at is we see about $3 trillion in spend now across our bank partners. And that's debit, credit, ACH, and bill pay. And why that matters is we have a really, really good view. I mean, it's about 1 in 2 card swipes in the United States. So we have a really robust view of what that means for consumer spend. And then we work with marketers, you know, the biggest retailers in the world, restaurant brands, travel brands, grocers, to figure out what does that mean for how their consumers are spending, not just with them, but where else they're spending. And then we apply that insight, those purchase insights, into the advertising or the cashback rewards that we're providing to bank customers. So that means that if, you know, if you're opening up your bank app and the cashback rewards that you receive that we power all interesting and relevant to you because it's based on your past purchase history. And then we really help marketers close the loop with what does an ad campaign or what does that reward campaign drive in terms of actual sales. So, you know, the data itself, I think we've said before, like it's really easy to geek out on the data, but I think the reason the data is so interesting and compelling and why we love what we're able to do is because we work with a lot of brands, particularly now, to try to figure out what is going on with consumer spend, what is the right way to offer something of value to consumers in a way that they need it now, and how do you actually still drive your business through these crazy, crazy times?
And so with that in mind, again, we're talking about the State of Spend report from May 2020, and I think perhaps the most interesting thing to me, just reading over the report, looking over the report, we know that there was some regional differences in terms of pandemic buying and the like. That makes sense as the virus was impacting different areas in different ways. But I think the most interesting thing for me is we saw different sized DMAs react to the pandemic differently as far as online shopping was concerned. I was wondering if you could maybe provide a little bit of color as far as the data you found with those different sized DMAs and how they were reacting, being pushed towards online shopping.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, a reminder for listeners, it's still, you know, take the last 3 months out of the equation. Typically about 80% of purchases are still happening in a store. And while, you know, over the past 3-4 years, we've certainly continued to see an increase in online shopping and e-commerce growing. What we've seen, and not a surprise, and this is super intuitive, but what we've seen in e-commerce since the coronavirus hit is just through the roof, as you can imagine, and some categories more than others, like online beauty up 41% year over year, online grocery up 146% year over year, the mass merchandisers, so big box stores, over 100% up year over year, pet stores, office supplies. So like certain categories, there has obviously been a huge push to online shopping. I think what's going to be interesting for, you know, what we're talking to our clients about and how we're working with retailers now is, as you mentioned, there's the DMA side and then there's going to be the long-term behavior. So on the DMA side, the DMAs are the cities that have really seen the biggest spike in online shopping since the beginning of the year are the smaller DMAs. Our understanding of that is really, there are a couple reasons. A, as stores are actually shut down, the smaller DMAs perhaps have fewer options near them, I think. In the city, there were still a few things here and there, depending on availability. But interestingly, I think it's also a little bit of a catch-up, right? The bigger cities perhaps using online shopping more. When we can actually break it down to the DMA level and see the smaller cities and how much rapid growth, like I think in California and Ohio and some of these smaller towns or smaller DMAs have seen year over year e-com growth of like 48%. And so it's going to be interesting for us to see consumer behavior has really, really changed in the last, you know, 3 to 4 months. How can retailers make sure that they try to continue that behavior? how will consumer shopping behavior change over time, even as we start to recover and come out the other side of this? I think that's what we're really going to be looking at. And as we work with our retail partners, help them to understand how do they make the most of, you know, I think we've talked about omni shopping on this podcast before. How do they make the most of putting what they have to offer in front of the consumers in a way that is how the consumers want to buy? And, you know, even as stores open back up and as DMAs open back up, it's really important to make sure that you're still offering what you offer online. And I'll give you an example, actually, of a client who is really looking at how to use the DMA data that we're working through with them. There are a lot of folks who have pause marketing budgets. And, you know, we have a major client of ours who has still kept certain segments running on our ad platform and still reaching people who are actually actively spending in their category, because typically those are probably going to be the first responders and the essential workers. And so it's a great way to still provide cash back to the folks who are spending. But we had, you know, historically pulled back on a lot of the targeting segments for folks who are not spending, because we didn't want to be irresponsible, right? We didn't want to drive people out of their homes into an unsafe environment. And so as cities open up, being able to look at spend and say, okay, we're really actively seeing a ton of e-com growth in the smaller DMAs. As those cities open up, how do you make sure that you go ahead and reach those consumers and try to make sure that you either get them back in store if you want them to, or keep them spending and keep that consumer behavior shift in place if it has benefited you?
So we talk about the drive there to try and retain those consumers that may have turned to you during the pandemic. But one of the interesting things that your report points out is that as people did kind of transition to online shopping, it's also become vital for those e-commerce pure plays that are out there to maybe hold on to their market share against the new entrants or the omni-channel entrants into the world. What were some of the things that you were seeing from maybe some of the e-commerce pure plays that you work with as far as them attempting to just hold on to their market share as we saw people kind of flood to those merchants like Kroger, like Target that have the omni-channel setup?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, whether there are pure play online players or they are folks who have both in-store, you know, brick and mortar and online, I think I'll give an example because I think that's probably the best way to showcase it. You know, one of the major online grocery players is a big client of ours. And I mean, the amount of share that they have captured in the last few months is crazy. The amount of customers that they've acquired is crazy. But now they recognize that, all right, as cities do open back up and folks are actually heading back, perhaps in store, they're really heavying up their marketing to those segments by DMA of cities that open up, to make sure that, you know, if you're doing your grocery shopping online, that you're not just going to automatically switch back to going in a store once it's available to do so. So a lot of their marketing strategy with us is to make sure that we appropriately reach and target the consumers through their bank apps as their cities open up to try to maintain that behavior. Because it's not just about acquiring that new customer, it's really about keeping them at every single purchase decision they make, right? And that's how you build loyalty. You have to look at the whole wallet of where are consumers spending, what channels are they spending in, what competitors are they spending in, and you have to drive that purchase decision every single time. And that is actually sort of folks who have seen that rise phenomenon in the spend in their category. We are now squarely focused on retention as we come out and as the economy starts to come back slowly. That is a number one focus for these brands right now. The same goes, quite honestly, for streaming players, on-demand fitness players. And there have been a lot of interesting, I never want to say people who have benefited from this, that's clearly not the right way to say it, but there have been a lot of categories who have seen a huge surge in clients, you know, including even pet store chains. Like pet store chains have seen a huge lift in online commerce. And it's now all about retaining and trying to encourage people to continue buying the way that they have for the last few months.
So we know we saw certain pandemic buying trends around consumables in March, but two categories we haven't really discussed on the show, but you mentioned it kind of with your first answer, beauty, fitness are both trending up there. What are some of the trends around consumer spend in those categories? Not just, you know, up or down, but in terms of also the cadence and how they're happening as well.
The beauty one's an interesting thing. You know, we actually saw, if you look in our first data spend report, and actually we've just recently put out one for June as well, so it's sort of cool to be able to see how things are changing over the weeks as this whole thing progresses. For beauty, first week of March, the beauty spend year over year for online beauty spend was actually down slightly. It was down, you know, about 3%. A little bit of that had to do with the fact that the year prior actually was quite high. So you're seeing like single digit growth, low to mid single digit growth as you head into the end of Q1. The last week of March, we saw a 33% year over year increase for online beauty shopping, you know, followed by 28, 54, 63 in the following weeks. The middle week of April, crazy, but 136% year over year growth in online beauty shopping. And I think, you know, you can make your funny guesses as to what that is. It's not just makeup, but are, you know, people dyeing their own hair, or are they buying their clippers to cut their sons and their, you know, husband's hair, as I have done in the last few weeks. So it's, you know, it's taking a little bit into account. I think what's interesting though, at the end of April, the last week of April, growth dropped back down to about 14%, but that's still, you know, basis points higher than the mid single digits we were seeing before. So I think as you actually look at a category like that, it's really important to look at it over time and say, okay, you know, one point change is significant business for a category based on what shoppers were doing before this whole thing hit. And then as we sort of get back into the go forward economy. For on-demand fitness, I think that's an area that we've been digging into for a while. And I think there has been a growing trend for consumers to do a lot more on-demand at-home workouts as it is. I think traditional gyms have really lost a lot of share over the last year. The boutique studios, same, like slightly down, but a huge, huge growth in on-demand fitness. I think what's been really cool to see is how have the traditional gyms, as they have had to shutter their doors, I mean, some are reopening now in certain states, but as they've had to close, how have they expanded their offering to make sure that folks are getting what they need at home? And all of a sudden, the on-demand fitness players, I mean, they've got it down to a good rhythm. They've got it down to a good cadence. But it'll be interesting to see whether the traditional gyms and boutique studios, you know, they're retailers at the end of the day, they're fitness retailers, how do they actually come back and perhaps steal a little share back because they are figuring out how to diversify their offering in a way that meets what consumers need. So I think that's going to be interesting for us to continue to watch in the coming months as well.
You know, we were talking with someone a few weeks ago that they mentioned it was unlikely to know for sure that we were in a recovery phase until the recovery had already happened. But that said, given what we know about spend trends overall, not just in particular categories, but spend trends overall through April, what is the data telling us not only about, you know, when the recovery might happen, but also how it might happen?
Yeah, that is a great question. And actually, I think if you look at our state of spend reports, both May and June, that is the first thing you see. So we look at the macro of how is overall spend, what's going on? Like, what is going on? And what we saw is we can actually bar chart it out by week. The week of March 26th to April 1st, we had seen a year-over-year change in spend for that week. We were down about 35%. Through the end of April, it was starting to curve back up. It's sort of the reverse. Everybody's talking about flattening the curve. This has really started to bring the curve back up the other way, where by the end of April, year-over-year spend was down about 21%. Through May 20th, which is the latest date that we've actually released, it's down about 13%. So you're certainly starting to see that U curve. You know, it'll be interesting to see, will it become a V? Will it become a U? How is spend actually coming back? That is overall spend. One of the new pieces that we've put into our June report is something that we've been using with our clients for the last few weeks already, but what we're calling the recovery indicator. And it actually takes out some of those categories that are normalizing that overall spend data. And I'll explain. So the categories that have seen a huge rise in spend, it's a little hard and misleading to tell what's happening with the categories that haven't. Like, what about folks who are restaurants where you need to do in-house dining? What about the retailers who are primarily brick and mortar led? What about entertainment spaces and apparel retailers and salons. And so what we've done is we've actually put out a new leading indicator that starts to look at just those categories. And, you know, at the lowest point, we were seeing in that same sort of late March timeframe, instead of spend being down 35%, when you just look at those kinds of categories, it was actually down 75% overall. But we're starting to see, as DMAs and states do make decisions to start slowly trying to be safely opening their economies, you know, spend is trending up. Through May, it's about down 51% year over year, as opposed to down 75% a month ago. It's not coming back as quickly for the obvious reason that locations aren't open yet. People aren't ready to come out yet. And so we actually track this on, you know, a weekly basis by state, by DMA. And in our June report, we actually show, you know, we have a little heat map that shows by state what the recovery indicator looks like. And we'll be continuing this over time so that as, you know, decisions are made to say, okay, it's potentially safe to come out with these parameters, we can actually see what that means for the economy. And the reason that matters for retailers and marketers is there are a lot of decisions to be made. It's not just where to advertise. I mean, that's our business, but it's about how do we actually safely change our business operations? How can we start to get a feel for trying to do the right thing for when consumers are coming out? Is spend actually following our openings? And it helps to make a lot of decisions that are quite operational, quite frankly. You know, what shall I do with my business? What is the right thing to do here based on what consumers are comfortable with?
So one final thing, and one of the reasons we're always excited to have you on the show, but especially in this circumstance, we were excited to have you on the show is because Cardlytics is some of the most comprehensive data surrounding retail spend around. That said, we've been curious. We've got a black swan event here with coronavirus, and that's produced a bunch of data that's going to be, by its very nature, kind of anomalous. I have to imagine that this period is going to skew things, like maybe year-over-year analysis when you're doing that in March of or April of 2021. So how are data analysts kind of looking at treating this data going forward? I don't know if treating is the best term to use, but how do you look at this data outside of how we know consumers are going to react around this very specific black swan event?
Yeah, it's a great question. The way that we work with our clients on this is just thinking about expanding the horizon of what you're looking at. You know, we always sort of talk about opening up the aperture, because if you just are looking at your own spend data, you're missing something if you're not looking at all of the spend data that informs your decisions. I would say the same is actually how we're working with clients from a time perspective. So this whole state of spend report, quite honestly, is just a packaged version of what we have been doing with our clients for a while and looking at spend on a week-to-week basis, cutting it a whole bunch of different ways that can inform their strategies. But if you think about it, you know, how does spend change over time? It's important to think about opening up the aperture from a time perspective. What did year-over-year growth look like in a category a year ago? What did it look like in January? What does it look like in March? What does it look like right now? And I think what will be interesting, it sort of comes back a little bit to that, you know, the online beauty example that I gave. It will be interesting to see, does spend return to the normal levels pre-COVID-19, or has consumer behavior really changed long-term as a result of this? And that is what we will continue to look at and we'll continue to report on. But I think, you know, it's going to mess up all kinds of models, of course. But I think looking at the data over time and then trying to figure out what does that mean for your new baseline? Has your baseline changed up or down? And really trying to analyze, you know, I was at single digit percent year over year growth before. Now I'm at 10%. How long will that last? And trying to maintain the behavior, or, you know, in the cases for those who are just trying to return responsibly, how to try to get that behavior, the consumer shopping behavior, back up. So yeah, it's going to be messy for analysts for a while, but I think the important thing is to look at consistent information over a long period of time to see what that means for how your consumers want to shop with you.
That's fantastic insight. I lied. I told you that last one would be the last question, but I do have like a last question for you.
Okay,
It's a very straightforward question. How happy were the members of your household with the haircuts that you gave them?
Super happy. I tell you what, I have a 6-year-old boy and I've done my husband's hair for a while and I'm an excellent hair cutter. It's Yeah, I have not yet attempted to cut my own, which I think my hairdresser would thank me for.
All right. You heard it here. Master hairstylist, but also the CMO of Cardlytics, Danny Cushion. Thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me back on, as always.
Now, 1 week after Leighton discussed them, actually, and are looking ahead, Southeastern Grocers makes a big announcement, actually a couple of big announcements, this in conjunction with Ahold Delhaize's Food Lion, who will see their footprint get a little bigger as part of the deal.
As we look into this announcement, very interesting, as it came just days after an announcement that Buy Low was introducing Instacart grocery delivery. While this is an important announcement for the short term, Southeastern Grocers announced this week their plans to phase out the Buy Low banner. Southeastern said they would prefer to focus on their Fresco y Mas, Harvey Supermarket, and Winn-Dixie banners. And this makes some sense, as they noted their desire to put Winn-Dixie stores in the newly acquired locations from Lucky's and Earth Fare that we discussed this last week. Still, you wonder why there was such a push to implement Instacart if the brand was just going to be ended or sold off, although not immediately, as we'll talk about, but still an interesting point there. Speaking about the sell-off, a deal was announced that would see Food Lion acquire 62 stores from Southeastern Grocers. The deal encompasses 46 Buy Low stores and 16 Harvey's Supermarket stores. Food Lion was clear that all of the stores would be rebranded to Food Lion locations once the deal was finalized. It makes sense why Food Lion, Ahold Delhaize, would choose to rebrand these locations, as they've been fairly clear about wanting to trim down their number of brands in the first place. Still, it is worth wondering how strong the Food Lion brand is in the Southeastern U.S. right now, with some noting that their in-store experience appears dark and stale, like an old grocery store back from the 1980s. Assuming the deal with Food Lion goes through, this would leave Southeastern Grocers with 61 locations under the Buy Low banner. The company does plan to seek strategic options for these stores. That is, they're seeking a buyer for them, essentially. Regardless of whether or not a buyer is found, the company was clear about wanting their store count to settle in at around 425 once the dust settles. This is down significantly from their bankruptcy exit in May of 2018, when their store count sat right around 575, according to an article in Produce Market Guide. The number currently sits at around 550 stores. As far as the Harvey's banner, the chain does want to keep the stores under their Southeastern Grocers umbrella. If the Food Lion deal goes through, there will be 30 Harvey's locations left, and Southeastern Grocers said they do want to seek options for two of the other stores, indicating its desire to retain the rest. Another big announcement Southeastern Grocers made in the same release was their plans to divest 57 in-store pharmacies to CVS and Walgreens. Think back to when Target divested theirs to CVS many years ago.
And this is going to be a different type of circumstance, because while they are divesting the in-store pharmacies, our understanding of the deal, based on the release and based on other news coverage of this, is that really what you're seeing is the pharmacy files being sold off, and the pharmacies will no longer continue to operate in those same locations. Now, the pharmacies are all currently in Buy Low and Harvey's stores in Georgia. In fact, all of their Buy Low Georgia pharmacies are included in this deal, and there's no indication as to what that space in the stores will be used for, but it's likely that a portion of these Buy Low stores were being sold off to Food Lion, and so it might be their decision to make, or whoever buys the remaining Buy Low locations, it's going to be their decision to make as far as how they can go about approaching that pharmacy section in their stores. Now, like I said, deal is just for the scripts, which can prove lucrative for Walgreens and CVS. Ultimately, looking at this, it's probably likely that Southeastern Grocers found that they could maximize their cash flow, which is what this deal is about. It's not like their backs were against the wall. It's not like they were being forced into this decision, but they wanted that cash flow coming in from this deal, and they felt like they could maximize that by splitting off the pharmacies in a separate deal, or the script files, rather than lumping them in with some of the stores for sale. So rather than turning around a Food Lion and saying, hey, you get the stores and the pharmacies as well as the script files, they're saying to Food Lion, hey, you get the stores, we're going to sell the script files to CVS and Walgreens because we know we can fetch higher dollar for them. So looking at, again, maximizing cash flow for this deal. Now, the pharmacy deal, unlike the deal for the stores, that should be a quick one on the execution front. The script files are expected to be moved in the next few weeks. So we're talking about a 2 to 3 week turnaround rather than something that might require regulatory approval. Also, as an aside, this is a big get for Walgreens in this area. Of course, important for CVS as well, but particularly for Walgreens, because we remember a few years back, Walgreens acquired a lot of the Georgia Rite Aid stores that were in that particular state. So Walgreens took over a lot of these stores. They're just starting to rebrand the stores, just starting to build sales. Layton actually talked to the store manager at a Georgia Walgreens location that was converted from a Rite Aid, and they said, hey, sales are indeed looking up at this particular location. So this is a big deal, especially for Walgreens, trying to drive more people into that particular brand, especially customers that may have been familiar with the old Rite Aid banner. Now, one thing that it's clear from the deal that Southeastern Grocers wants to do is they want to use the funds to build out their current banners and reinvest in the store refreshes. They estimate that about 40% of their stores have been refreshed since the 2018 Chapter 11 bankruptcy that they went through. Now, 40% is a good number, but it's not 100%. So this cash will come in handy insofar as refreshing the remaining 60% of the stores, continuing to build out some of their omni-channel options for customers. They've been partnering with Instacart and Shipt of late and rolled out those partnerships over the last couple of months in some of their banners, but also opening some new locations in areas that might be higher traffic, like those planned new Winn-Dixie stores coming from the purchase of the leftover Lucky's locations and the leftover Earth Fair locations that we discussed last week, but also potentially maybe expanding their Winn-Dixie store footprint a little bit further. You know, it's part of a grocer's job, basically, as you manage your portfolio to make sure that you are in up-and-coming residential areas. And this is something that we see from grocers that are struggling, not being able to do, not building out those new locations, not refreshing those locations. And so it is promising for Southeastern Grocers to be able to have that cash on hand to build out their Fresco y Mas and their Winn-Dixie locations, the ones, the banners that they feel like are really driving traffic and really ultimately driving revenue for the company. And in our final news story here on the podcast, we're going to stay with grocery. This time we're going to look at the macro as we get more insight on how pandemic buying patterns affected grocers in the produce section. As we talked about in the intro, we've talked about meat, frozen food, and consumer staples, and now it's time for fresh produce to get the spotlight, courtesy of the United Fresh Produce Association's Fresh Facts on Retail for the first quarter that just came out.
What is somewhat expected here, but interesting nonetheless, is that a lot of top 10 fruits by volume historically saw dollar sales gains except for one. The outlier was grapes. Odd, given that there was a greater demand for snacking produce in the quarter. Grape volume was up, but dollar sales were down 1.3%. This might make some sense when viewed through the lens of pandemic panic buying in March, but customers were seeking produce that might last a little bit longer in storage. So you would think that grapes would be maybe number one or close to that. And to that end, citrus was a big winner, with lemons, oranges, and mandarins all up 20% in dollar sales. Lemons, too, have benefited from a greater number of people cooking at home. Trent, I know you have been cooking a lot lately. However, the argument that highly perishable produce may not have attracted customers buying with an eye towards the pandemic begins to erode when you look at raspberry sales. Fresh raspberry sales were up 15% over the first quarter in 2019. On the vegetable front, it was again the veggies that could be stored for longer periods of time that carried the first quarter. We had seen quotes from produce managers discussing the relatively strong demand for potatoes and onions, but here we see the numbers behind that. From February 15th through March 31st, dollar sales for potatoes were up 37.7%, with dollar sales for onions up 20.6%. Carrots also followed suit, 15%. They were up. Onions are an interesting case here. The massive demand in March through May has apparently depleted many of the storage reserves for packing companies, even with decreased restaurant demand. Therefore, it is possible that we'll see slightly increased retail prices for onions until the California crop comes in. This might be just in a few months. The remainder of the onion crop in the United States should follow suit in late summer. What is perhaps most interesting is that household penetration for fruits was down overall 90 basis points to 91.6% of grocery shoppers. This is the exact opposite of what we saw when looking at frozen fruits and vegetables, which saw market penetration up across the board during March and April. And Trent, I know you have a lot to talk about. And like I said, you've been cooking a lot, but I know that you're a huge fan of produce, whether it's fruits or vegetables. You're definitely an all seasons buyer, not just a pandemic buyer.
That is correct. And I think longtime listeners of the podcast could have probably figured that out, because the produce section, honestly, it is one of the more interesting aspects of retail grocery, because you look at the turnover required, you look at the fact that you're talking about items that aren't really shelf stable, so you've got to have that turnover going. You've got to make sure that markdowns are well timed and exact, and that's what makes it such an intriguing part of retail grocery. Now, when we look at some of the other things coming out of this study, I think you mentioned late in snacking was up, and certainly it was up for fruits, at least. Down slightly for vegetables, 1.3% in terms of dollar change. So snacking was kind of on the whole between fruits and vegetables, more or less unmoved. It was slightly up in the aggregate. But what I found interesting is that meal prep sales of fruits in retail stores was down 12.5% in terms of dollar value over last year. Now, meal prep for vegetables sales there were up. So we'll leave it to you to decide exactly what this means, because ultimately you saw an influx of people going back to meal prep services, especially mail order meal prep services. But also this indicates that you're also seeing sales in retail meal prep services go up, at least on the vegetable front. You're seeing inclusions of fruits there maybe go down just a little bit. And I think some of the other things, when you look at value-added produce, it's a little all over the place, because you look at watermelons, value-added watermelon sales. So basically the watermelon that you get in the retail store that's cut up, that's prepared, that's already ready to eat. You're not having to cut into the watermelon yourself. That was up big. That was up 14.2% over last year and was now the third highest value-added category in retail produce. Yet you look at mixed fruit, that was down. You look at cantaloupe, that was down. And you look at apples, the pre-prepared apples, that was down. And you'll recall about 2 months ago, we talked about the importance of the pre-packaged, the pre-bag apples on the retail store, how more people are reaching for those pre-packaged 2 and 3 pound bags than are reaching for bulk apples now, because people are looking to get in and out relatively quickly, or at least more so during pandemic buying conditions. And we see an interesting trend here in that people are willing to buy the 2 or 3 pound bags of apples, but are not willing to buy cut up apples during a pandemic. Now, the biggest question is this because of maybe some of those recessionary buying habits coming in? We know, for example, when we look at past recessions, sales of baby carrots go down because people just buy the whole carrots because they figure, okay, well, I don't need the baby carrots that are already prepared, that are already ready to go. I can spend a little bit of time preparing it and save, you know, a dollar or two over just buying the 2 pound bag of carrots. Are we seeing the same phenomenon here in apples, or is there a different reason why these pre-made apples are going down? Maybe it's because people have more time at home to prepare those apples. And also one thing that I would posit is that we saw a decline in children going to school because they were learning at home during really the last part of the school year. So maybe you saw that fall back in those pre-prepared apples, pre-prepared cantaloupe, pre-prepared pineapple, and mixed fruit. All of those categories were down. Maybe that was because kids weren't going to school for a part of the first quarter. So I think there's a lot of interesting dynamics here. But for vegetables, value-added vegetables, so pre-prepared broccoli and carrots, were both up. So I mentioned baby carrots and how they tend to see declines in sales during recessionary buying habits. We actually saw baby carrots and ready-to-eat carrots and broccoli, those sales go up. So mixed signals here, and it could just have to do maybe with preference. Maybe it's got something to do with the fact that people were staying at home. But ultimately, I think in aggregate, you look, vegetable and fruit sales were up. And that's the biggest thing to drive home for the produce section. Again, a lot of this driven by things like potatoes, like citrus, like onions that were shelf-stable for a longer period of time. Overall, dollar amount in terms of produce moved Q1, so the entire quarter, January 1st through March 31st, versus 2019 was up 7.1% in terms of dollar amount. Now, in terms of unit amount, so the physical amount of produce sold, that was actually up 7.4%. So we see prices going down just a little bit, but people ultimately buying more vegetables and fruits. So what then does this mean for the third quarter? You look at big categories historically in the third quarter. You look at cantaloupe, corn, watermelon. Those are the big things. Well, we already talked about pre-prepared cantaloupe. That was going down. So how will that affect what retailers stock in the third quarter? And given the popularity of watermelon, do retailers stock more whole watermelons? Do they decide to have more pre-prepared watermelon available in stores? We're going to see those dynamics come into play in Q3 because you're going to see the influx of that produce in stores as the crops begin to come in. So a lot of interesting things to look at least when looking ahead to the third quarter and wondering how these numbers from Q1 will affect those Q3 numbers, if at all.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Slayton and I pick a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or potentially year. And Layton's going with a retailer that maybe didn't have the best prior quarter based on both PR and sales.
Yeah, that's right. My retailer for my story is GameStop, a retailer that we've been talking about a lot on the podcast because of their massive debt burden and their sales declines due to not a lot of new game systems being released and just a lot of game sales going online. So digital uploads, that kind of thing, really hurting GameStop's model. It's hurt them so much so that we've talked about in the past year, they're ramping up in other merchandise sales. So you think of maybe things like plush characters that are in the video games, keychains, that kind of thing. T-shirts are being now sold at GameStop, and I think it's taking over more of the sales volume, but they haven't been able to sell any of that lately, and that's why it's my going ahead story, is they've been having to shut down a lot of their locations due to the pandemic. Some locations were actually able to stay open, oddly enough, none by me in Southern California, and roughly 3/4 of international GameStop locations also had to come to a halt over the last couple of months. But you saw after an initial sales bump in March, GameStop analysts and GameStop executives were excited about the potential for maybe the spring and summer sales season, but it just obviously did not happen because of the pandemic. There's a little bit of good news here, Trent, and this mostly has to do with the net loss that they could be coming in with, around $160 to $172 million. But you're looking at that loss and you're saying, what are the bright spots? Well, one bright spot is they're doing an exchange offer for $414 million in senior notes due next year. Guess what? If you're hemorrhaging that amount of money, you're not going to be paying those senior notes off. But it's interesting in that those holders, the holders of those current senior notes, opted for, again, what they call an exchange offer, essentially an extension of those notes' maturity for 2023 at a higher interest rate. So basically, they're hedging risk here. They're saying, okay, we'll push back the maturity date for these senior notes, but we get a higher interest rate as a result of doing business with a retailer that may not be around in 2023. So if you look a little deeper here, Trent, you're seeing that, again, the company is up against a lot, but they are hedging on maybe stronger online sales for one, and then for two, pretty steady sales later in the year as new hardware comes out. And we're talking a lot of things hardware here, but it's not just these game systems from Sony or Microsoft. You're talking the things that go in these game systems nowadays, Trent. It's a huge, huge topic for the gaming industry, one that honestly, I'm mostly ignorant of, but you have a lot of new things coming out on the market. You think of graphics cards, you think of motherboards, all of the things that go into PC gaming that can affect the sales there in GameStop. So it's fairly interesting. A lot of brand new hardware is coming out, and it's going to really enhance the experience of those gamers, especially those gamers that really love that new technology, love the idea that they can be fully immersed in some of these games. And right now during the pandemic, I think you're seeing that a lot of people are choosing to stay at home, watch movies. They have nothing else to do, play video games. And I think that will have some carryover effect, because if you think of the typical age of a gamer, it's probably around college age, right? So a lot of people that are not going to be going to school in the fall, in the brick and mortar setting at least, they may be taking online classes, will have a greater opportunity to spend more time playing games at home or in their dormitory, wherever they are. So I think that is the positive light here for GameStop. It's just basically pushing the debt burden down the road in hopes that they can marginally increase sales in the midterm. And so that's where they stand. But I think it's interesting that a lot of people are saying that they're not entirely dead yet. The last thing I will say, though, is if you look at their five-year stock chart, it does appear as though death is coming very shortly. 5 years ago, their stock price was hovering around $45 a share. It's now around $4.14 per share, a tiny market cap of $267 million. And again, that's about just twice the amount of loss that they're anticipated to take in for this latest quarter.
And one thing I'll mention just to clarify, Leighton, to what you were speaking of, if you just like Google search the average age of a video game player, you'll find that the average age is about 35 years old. However, that typically includes mobile gaming. So you think of games that are available for download on cell phones, that type of thing. Ages for those type of video games skew a little bit older, whereas ages do skew a little bit younger for the type of, you know, console-related games to which GameStop really caters. So did want to go ahead and back that up just to prevent any potential tweets saying like, oh, gamers are a little bit older than what Leighton said. In this term, we're looking at exactly who GameStop's core customer might be coming out of the pandemic. Well, my looking ahead story is a story that garnered a lot of negative news, but it could actually be a net positive in terms of looking at the growth of the company, because Stitch Fix said this week it's going to lay off 1,400 of its stylists in California. That was what garnered the headlines. However, they're actually hiring 2,000 stylists in other areas of the U.S., so they're actually adding 600 net employees. Now, obviously, this is not a good thing for the stylists who are in California. Stitch Fix, in so doing, is basically acknowledging the fact that, hey, it doesn't much matter where our stylists are located. What matters is the fact that we're able to service our customers. And if we could do so by paying perhaps the stylists less because the cost of living is less in other areas of the country, we will do so. And they're looking at hiring stylists in Austin and Dallas. Now, Austin's cost of living is up there, but Dallas is still relatively reasonable. Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Minneapolis as well, all of whom are said to have very reasonable costs of living compared with California. And Leighton, of course, you live in California, so you know exactly what we're talking about in terms of high rent or high mortgage payments there. Generally speaking, higher costs for things like groceries and the like, higher costs for gasoline, all of that leading to a higher cost of living, which means oftentimes to attract employees, companies have to pay more. So Stitch Fix is maybe looking at changing their model a little bit. And the reason I'm looking ahead is not so much to focus on Stitch Fix, but to focus on other e-commerce retailers. Now, of course, distribution centers and fulfillment centers have to be spread throughout the country. So you're likely to have one along the West Coast or multiple along the West Coast. But in terms of the people servicing your customer group, so you rather than what we would see in the brick and mortar stores having to work physically on location. You can really work from anywhere. So is this something that more e-commerce companies will attempt to do? And we've seen pushes from certain cities, Omaha, Nebraska being one of them, saying, hey, if you run a business that can reasonably run from anywhere, move here because we have a low cost of living and we have a great city. We've seen the same push out of South Dakota, which is one of the reasons why South Dakota is one of the largest employers in the entire nation when it comes to call center employees. So that's why I'm looking ahead to see if more companies will follow this pattern from Stitch Fix. You know, it's very chic to have your offices in New York or California, but overall, how much sense does it make to have your headquarters or have a large number of employees in these locations when you have to pay them so much money? Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast for this week. Big thanks once again to Danny Cushion, the CMO of Cardlytics, for joining us earlier. And also a big thanks to Easy Texting for bringing you this episode. Next week, we'll have a discussion with Nikki Baird, the VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos. And Nikki will be joining us to discuss exactly what companies could be or should be doing with the inventory they've accumulated during the course of the pandemic. A lot of those decisions to be made, and also how companies can evaluate properly their brick and mortar portfolio going ahead. We're looking forward to that, and we'll see you about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.